Seattle, too. What do you think about Seattle? I sat down on the bed. It was starting to take hold of me, too, the giddiness of flight. My knees shook, and I felt myself grin. Everything was racing. I said, "What about Roy?" She kept on packing. "What about him?" "I don't know. Is he coming too?" "Not if I can help it, he isn't." She said she hoped that was okay with me. I didn't answer. I was afraid of saying something she would remember if they got back together. But I was glad to be once more on the run, and glad that I would have her to myself again. "I know you two are close," she said. "Not that close." She said there wasn't time to explain everything now, but later on she would. She tried to sound serious, but she was close to laughing, and so was I. "Better check your room," my mother said again. "When are we leaving?" "Right away. As soon as we can." I ate a bowl of soup while my mother finished packing. She carried the suitcases into the front hall and then walked down the corner to call a cab. That was when I remembered the rifle. I went to the closet and saw it there with Roy's things, his boots, jackets, and ammo boxes. I carried the rifle to the living room and waited for my mother to come back. "That thing stays," she said when she saw it.
"It's mine," I said.
"Don't make a scene," she told me. "I've had enough of those things. I'm sick of them. Now put it back."
"It's mine," I repeated. "He gave it to me."
"No, I'm sick of guns."
"Mom, it's mine."
She looked out the window. "No, we don't have room for it." This was a mistake. She had put the argument in practical terms, and now it would be impossible for her to argue from principle again.
"Look," I said, "there's room. See, I can break it down."
And before she could stop me, I had unscrewed the locking bolt and pulled the rifle apart. I dragged one of the suitcases back into the living room and unzipped it and slid the two halves of the rifle in between the clothes.
"See," I said, "there's plenty of room."
She had watched all this with her arms crossed, her lips pressed tightly together. She turned to the window again.
"Keep it, then," she said, "if it means that much to you."
It was raining when our cab pulled up. The cabbie honked, and my mother started wrestling one of the suitcases down the steps. The cabbie saw her and got out to help, a big man in a fancy Western shirt that got soaked in the drizzle. He went back for the other two bags while we waited in the cab. My mother kidded him about how wet he was, and he kidded her back, looking in the rear-view mirror constantly as if to make sure she was still there. As we approached the Greyhound station, he stopped joking and began to quiz her in a low, hurried voice, asking one question after another. And when I got out of the cab, he pulled the door shut behind me, leaving the two of them alone inside. Through the rain streaming down the window, I could see him talking, and my mother smiling and shaking her head. And they both got out, and he took our bags from the trunk.
"You're sure now?" he said to her.
She nodded. When she tried to pay him, he said that her money was no good. Not to him, it wasn't. But she held it out again, and he took it. My mother broke out laughing after he drove away.
"Of all things," she said.
She kept laughing to herself as we hauled the bags inside, where she settled me on a bench and went to the ticket window. The station was empty, except for a family of Indians. All of them, even the children,
looked straight ahead, and said nothing. A few minutes later, my mother came back with our tickets. The Phoenix bus had left already, and the next one didn't come through until late that night, but we were in luck. There was a bus leaving for Portland in a couple of hours, and from there we could make an easy connection to Seattle. I tried to conceal my disappointment, but my mother saw it and bought me off with a handful of change. I played the pinball machines for a while, and then stocked up on candy bars for the trip, Milk Duds and Sugar Babies and Idaho Spuds, most of which were already curdling in my stomach when at dusk we boarded our bus and stood in the dazed regard of the other passengers. We hesitated for a moment, as if we might get off. Then my mother took my hand, and we made our way down the aisle, nodding to anyone who looked at us, smiling to show we meant well. Uncool. We lived in a boarding house in West Seattle. At night, if my mother wasn't too tired, we took walks around the neighborhood, stopping in front of different houses to consider them as candidates for future purchase. We went for the biggest and most pretentious, sneering at ranches and duplexes, anything that smelled of economy. We chose half-timbered houses, houses with columns, houses with sculpted bushes in front. Then we went back to our room, where I read novels about heroic collies, while my mother practiced typing and shorthand so she wouldn't fall behind in her new job. Our room was in a converted attic. It had two camp beds, and between them, under the window, a desk and chair. It smelled of mildew. The yellow wallpaper was new, but badly hung and already curling at the edges. It was the kind of room that B-movie detectives wake up in, bound and gagged, after they've been slipped a Mickey. The boarding house was full of old men, and men who probably only seemed old. Besides my mother, only two women lived there. One was a secretary named Kathy. Kathy was young and plain and shy. She stayed in her room most of the time. When people addressed her, she would look at them with a drowning expression, then softly ask them to repeat what they had said. As time went on, her pregnancy began to show through the loose clothes she wore. There didn't seem to be a man in the picture. The other woman was Marion, the housekeeper. Marion was big and loud. Her arms were as thick as a man's, and when she pounded out hamburger patties, the whole kitchen shook. Marion went with a Marine sergeant from Bremerton, who was even bigger than she was, but more gentle and soft-spoken. He had been in the Pacific during the war. When I kept after him to tell me about it, he finally showed me an album of photographs he'd taken. Most of the pictures were of his buddies, Doc, a man with glasses, Curly, a man with no hair, Jesus, a man with a beard. But there were also pictures of corpses. He meant to scare me off the subject with these pictures, but instead they made me more interested. Finally, Marion told me to stop bothering him. Marion and I disliked each other. Later, we both found reasons for it, but our dislike was instinctive and mysterious. I tried to cover mine with a treacly stream of yes-ma'ams and no-ma'ams and offers of help. Marion wasn't fooled. She knew I didn't like her, and that I was not the young gentleman I pretended to be. She went out a lot, running errands, and sometimes she saw me on the street with my friends, bad company from the looks of them. She knew I combed my hair differently after I left the house and rearranged my clothes. Once, driving past us, she yelled at me to pull up my pants. My friends were Terry Taylor and Terry Silver. All three of us lived with our mothers. Terry Taylor's father was stationed in Korea. The war had been over for 2 years, but he still hadn't come home. Mrs. Taylor had filled the house with pictures of him, graduation portraits, snapshots in and out of uniform, always alone, leaning against trees, standing in front of houses. The living room was like a shrine. If you didn't know better, you would have thought that he had not survived Korea, but had died some kind of hero's death there, as Mrs. Taylor had perhaps anticipated. This sepulchral atmosphere owed a lot to the presence of Mrs. Taylor herself. She was a tall, stooped woman with deep-set eyes. She sat in her living room all day long and chain-smoked